going on, everybody? Kevin Cole back after an extended absence. Hopefully I didn't mess anything up here in the very modest production capacities that I have going on here. My hair is kind of messed up. Anybody watching live can see that. Desperately in need of a haircut. Need to get that going. Maybe I'll do this later this afternoon. We'll see. It's an open afternoon for me. So that's why I decided to jump in here, do a little solo potting, take some questions. If you have anything in the comments, I'll just go ahead and write here, say drop Q&A here. And also, I think I said something out on Twitter. Some people may send some questions there and some comments to the Unexpected Points Substack. Might as well plug that right up top. Get in there if you want to see anything, all the different research that I've been doing this year. A little bit of a different flavor. Similar, but different. So I'm repeating some of the same stuff that I had done before for the draft stuff. I'm not doing as much of the like running back wide receiver projections, which is probably more applicable to fantasy football. I guess I could do that next week. I could drop a pre-draft or post-draft one on that. Sticking more in the quote unquote real football sphere, including a Brock Bowers article or more like tight end drafted early article that I put out recently that should be of interest to some people. I'll talk about that a bit as leading up to the draft and we go over kind of some major themes. So yeah, so my agenda here, filibuster for a while on here, maybe just tell everyone what's going on, create that parasocial relationship that I'm hearing is so important to the podcasting business here, letting you in on what's going on in my oh so interesting life of someone who is middle-aged with kids who are 8 and 11. Okay, well, someone says they want the wide receiver projections. Okay, you know, I can put it together pretty quickly. Maybe I'll do that on Monday. So we'll do some of that. We'll talk about some big themes from this draft that's coming up here. My general, I don't know, what would you call it? Ennui? Is that how you say it? The French word for kind of apathy when it comes to thinking about the draft anymore and the particular players and everything else. I don't know. I'm reaching a nihilist, Arby's nihilist point of my life of, you know, let's just get to the draft. Let's get to the draft in, right? So we'll talk about some of the themes that are going on the draft here, some of the stuff that I've written, and then we'll get into the Q&A. Any questions you guys have, we can open it up, draft related, offseason related, analytics related, what we think is going to happen in 2024. Hey, if you guys want to talk some soccer, a lot of soccer watching going on here. Football, international football for our friends overseas who want to call it that. I kind of want to call it that myself too, but then I feel like a snob saying that as an American. I got to stick to soccer. So anyway, we've been watching a lot of that. I think it's definitely some lessons that are applicable. I think it's the second time I've said applicable to this podcast. Over to the NFL, although I think there's more congruence and shared analysis probably when we're talking about basketball, probably hockey too. I'm not really into hockey though, probably basketball and soccer. But anyway, I can discuss all that, those sorts of things. All right. So let's talk draft and draft themes here. Some of this is going to delve into areas that are also going to be covered in some of the questions that I've accumulated so far, at least that I've seen so far. And the first being, and I don't think we could get away from talking about the quarterbacks of this particular draft. Not only is it the most draft capital is going to be spent on the position, at least relative to, you know, how many are on the roster for these different NFL teams, right? You normally only have a few quarterbacks on the roster, a couple sometimes who are active on game day, but now we have this whole third quarterback can be active on game day thing. So we don't have to have wide receivers out there running read options and chucking the ball up if a quarterback's getting injured. So relative to the denominator of how many quarterbacks are really being used on the roster by these teams, there's going to be a ton of draft capital spent on them this year. I think this class and some of the numbers back this up that I have that I think you can look at if you're looking at consensus big board rankings. Also, if you're looking at one of the few, maybe only, kind of public long-standing analytical models that are out there. That's formerly Football Outsiders. Now Aaron Schatz is with FTN Data. So he talks, he has projections, and they're really good here. At least they're really good in framing. I think they're really good in results, too, if we look at back at some of this. But they're really good in framing as far as range of outcomes. So I'll talk about that. But I think the big theme when I'm thinking about quarterbacks, I'm thinking about this draft class, thinking, okay, do you need to trade up or not? How much should you trade up? What are the teams like the Vikings and the Broncos and some others, maybe the Raiders, who are quarterback needy, acutely quarterback needy? And in the case of the Vikings, for sure, I think are hitting the life cycle of the GM and coaching life cycle where, you know, they kind of got to make something happen. I mean, maybe the fans will be able to sort through 1 year of, you know, rebuild, but it's tough to have a rebuild year after a year where you don't make the playoffs. That might be enough to have them shown the door. So I think the Vikings are going to be acutely aware of the fact that they want to kind of restart things with the new quarterback here. Like, well, what should those teams be doing? So I think the first thing we want to think about is, I am just generally, so let's start the furthest away, right? Let's look that we can we have this concentric circles. Let's move a little closer and closer into the specifics of this particular draft class. So let's start all the way out. All the way out is quarterbacks are not overvalued, or they're not pushed up the board. Teams are not reaching for them. I have found absolutely no evidence of that. Sure, you can point to specific quarterbacks that don't work out and say, oh, they didn't deserve their draft spot. They were, you know, steamed up. They weren't worthy of that sort of pick. All of those sorts of things. Yet, if we're going to say, you know, guys who are projects, guys who aren't worth it, guys who, you know, on your general draft rankings where they talk about value of these different guys and big boards, where are they on my big board versus where they're going to be drafted? Yeah, a lot of these guys are going to be drafted earlier. The problem is, if that's your philosophy, these quarterbacks are being moved up too high, well, where was Patrick Mahomes drafted, number 10 overall, versus where he was on big boards? I don't think anyone had him on big boards higher than that. Maybe someone did, but remember, he was someone who was seen as being a fringe first round, maybe early second round pick early in the process. And it was a little bit of a surprise, I would say, if not a big surprise, when the Chiefs moved up to grab him at number 10, making him the second quarterback in the process. So if you're according to this philosophy of, you know, these quarterbacks have flaws, things like that, Chris Sims. Yeah, what's up with this Chris Sims? Okay, so let's put it Chris Sims. The problem with Chris Sims, okay, I don't know. Actually, I don't know enough to say. I know he's had some good rankings, but, you know, what's the methodology? I'll talk about that in a second. I'm getting way ahead here. I'll bring up Chris Sims, though, because someone threw it in there, and I know that his rankings look pretty good after the fact. But what about his big board rankings? Okay, big board, because, you know, these guys will love to tell you that, you know, Marvin Harrison should be taken above every quarterback this year, according to their big board. So quarterbacks are not steamed up in these situations, whether it's Patrick Mahomes, whether it's Justin Herbert. Famously, I was at PFF at the time and in the background scratching my head when even the analytical PFF, which I think leaned a little too much into its own numbers-based accuracy metrics and things like that, gave the Chargers a F on draft night for that pick for Herbert. And a lot of people were off of Herbert. A lot of the film hipsters off of Herbert. A lot of everyone off of Herbert. So, right? So Herbert would have been a guy that wouldn't have been that high on the big boards as he was when he was drafted. You missing out on him. Josh Allen. Actually, I'm not sure about Allen because Allen's an interesting case where He was seen as being as a potential number one overall pick. And the Mel Kipers and Matt Millers of the world really loved him after his redshirt sophomore season. And then after his redshirt junior season, things went off the rails a little bit. So him going at seventh overall actually might not have been that high according to people. But let's face it, he wasn't like a rock solid prospect or someone like that. So Josh Allen, you miss out on. Lamar Jackson actually is someone who went later than where he was on big boards. One of the few who went later than when he was on big boards. But like, if you would have taken Jackson in the top 10, would anyone have been complaining about it? No, you know, no one would have been complaining about it. Jalen Hurts, that's another one. You know, oh, you shouldn't take him. People thought that was too early in like the mid second round. I'm the Jalen Hurts guy, by the way. That's my claim to fame. At least one of my claims to fame. Probably my most read article I ever wrote was that it was a great pick after the fact when Philly media was going nuts. So I try not to back pat myself too much, but I'm literally patting my own back right now on that one. And it wasn't because I even thought that he was a great player. I'm not doing these. I was just like, it's a good pick. Why not go for it? So there are flaws always. And this comes into the general kind of my general philosophy when it comes to drafting, and especially when we talk about trading up to get a particular player from a particular tier or not, these quarterbacks, others. The differences between these players, and I think the difference between, in my opinion, Caleb Williams and everyone else for this draft, and why I would put him in a tier above everyone else. And I think that's kind of how things have sorted out in the consensus, and you see the Commanders kind of ambivalence here on who they're going to take number two. You had a lot of people during last season. I remember the Ringer's quarterback rankings by my man, Steve Ruiz. I think he put May above Williams at one point in those. You know, those takes are all dead. Those takes are all dead. It's amazing how those takes kind of align with our draft expectations as things go along. Or maybe that take's still there. Actually, Steve, if you're there, hit me up. Let me know if you're still on May Island. But the difference between these tiering, though, is not really on upside. I think that's the problem when a lot of people are looking at these picks. A lot of people say, well, you trade up to get more upside. Like you trade up, let's say, for Caleb Williams versus May or Daniels or McCarthy or Nix or Penix or whoever, right? Because like you're accessing a tier of player, and I think this is more common in other sorts of positions. When people justify trade ups, they say, "Oh, he was getting the last top offensive tackle, who's really like a blue chipper type of player, like an all pro ceiling player." That's not really the difference. That's not really the difference. It's really more of a median outcome for the stat terminology. Mean versus median. It's the same thing in this because I kind of see a normal distribution. But anyway, like the middle most likely sort of, not most likely outcome, but the middle of the distribution outcome. I guess mode would technically be the most likely outcome. But anyway, sorry, stat 101 talk here. I get confused on this stuff. I'm like a State at a Holiday Inn Express data scientist, not an actual data scientist. So like that sort of outcome is what you're really going to get the boost for. And if you look at like the Cubase projections for this year, should I even try to bring this up? Let's go for it. Let's do the share screen here. I'm giving you guys some access to, I believe, paywalled content here. So hopefully you can see it here. All right, so let's bring it up here. So this is the Cubase projections from my man Aaron Schatz. And this is kind of like a plug, so I don't think he'll mind that I'm bringing them up here. But if you look at these things, it has like a mean projection. I think this is what people are focused on probably too much, the mean projection. So it has Williams at TDYAR divided by A. I'm not even sure what that is, honestly. Total defense adjusted yards above replacement per attempt. That's a mouthful. So it has that at 0.61, and then when it goes down to May is basically flat. Daniels a little bit higher at 0.34, McCarthy 0.2. So, you know, like it's basically saying that Williams, and part of this is based upon where his positioning in the big board at one, is his mean projection, which is pretty similar to his median projection. If you look at the distribution of outcomes he has here for the different tiers, is twice as high, basically, as anyone else. And I think that's fair, right? When you go over some of these guys, when you're moving up into that tier, you're not actually accessing the higher upside, you're accessing the higher mean. And you're accessing maybe a higher percent chance that you hit that elite number. Now, according to Cubase, how they're doing is they're saying this elite number, which is, again, look at his mean is 0.61. An elite number, according to this, is 1.5. So it's more than two times higher than his mean. But this is what we're interested in, really, is like elite or maybe upper tier, where we're talking about 1.5 to 2.5x what their mean projection is. That's what we're interested in. You know, that's at 21%. And if you go down to May, hey, it's quite a bit lower at 8.9%. If you go up to Daniels, according to their numbers, is 14.4%. But guess what? That upside's still there, right, for Daniels. It's not that he can't reach this elite number. It's just he has a, you know, 60% as good of a chance as Williams does. If you want to flip it around, you could say that Williams is roughly, let's see, so it's 21 versus 14, so that's 7. So it's 50% more likely to reach that elite number. That's what we're talking about here. That's what we have to frame in all these different things. A lot of times, people like to frame the blue chippers, the trading up, the quarterbacks, everything else as the justification for taking them at a certain level, for using a certain amount of draft capital, is the fact that they could be another Aaron Donald, or they could be another Patrick Mahomes, or they could be another one of these really great players. And that range of outcomes is not accessible to someone else. No, it's accessible further down. I mean, whether you want to, you know, do something like, Tom Brady or something like that later on, you want to talk about a Tony Romo who was a undrafted free agent. I mean, it's, you don't just whittle away any possibility. It's not null, the possibility that you can have an elite quarterback if you're an undrafted player like Tony Romo. It exists. What the bust percentage is much higher. The median or mean outcome is much lower. That's the big difference. And I think that's how you have to view not only this quarterback class, but you have to be willing to view the rest of the things here. So I think that's the big way we're going to look at it. Caleb Williams has solidified himself because he's probably not going to be a bust. As likely to be a bust. Now, it still shows here a 30% chance of being a bust. So, you know, it's like the Sex Panther cologne in Anchorman. You know, 60% of the time it works every time. So 60% of the time, 70% of the time, according to this, Caleb Williams isn't a bust. It works every time. The other 30% of the time, not so hot. I mean, but even if he's an adequate starter, which again, 25% here, this is kind of giving you a good range of like a solid number one overall pick. We're still talking about more than 50% of the time, you're either a bust or an adequate starter. Adequate starter is not getting someone excited. And less than 50% of the time, you're getting some people excited here. Now, it's a very low projection for May here, which I think is interesting. I wish I could dig into some of these things. Completion percentage, it seems to be a pretty bit low. Only a two-year starter, and his performance regressed relative to 2022. I did notice some of those same things. I'm going to be looking at the metrics that I like to look at, like pressure to sacks and scramble rate. And May did get worse. He had a higher percentage of pressures, which turned into sacks last year than the year before. I'm kind of the opinion where I think that matters to me, but it also is something that matters a little bit less if you've had a better year before. And the two-year starter question, which I think Cubase is one of the few, was one of the analytical formulas, which I really like the fact that they brought in how many years you were a starter as being something. Now, there was a bit of overfitting probably to that. And that's why I identified guys like Russell Wilson, like Philip Rivers, like others who were four-year starters. Well, Russell Wilson in particular, because he's a third rounder as a four-year starter, where he wasn't really good for three of those 4 years. And then he was great after he transferred for his fourth year. So probably gave him too much credit there. So, you know, for May, a young guy like May, I'm not going to look down as much on the 2 year starting as it is for others. He didn't have very good. Well, actually, I guess he had some good receivers last year who then went away. So it'll be an interesting one. Now for Daniels, I don't know. I would probably be a little bit more conservative on Daniels. I don't like the guys who make the huge jumps, who are that old necessarily. But again, I'm not going to disqualify him for that. From what I've seen of him, and again, I'm not seeing a lot. I think this is happens to a lot of different guys here. Pressure to sack has been a big thing for him. It's got a lot of hype out there. And the thing is, not only was it not great last year, like he's taking a decent amount of sacks under pressure, but it was actually worse the year before. Now, I know everything was worse the year before. He's been around so long. He made that late jump, which you could compare to, if you wanted to, someone like Joe Burrow. I don't think it's necessarily comparable. But it was even, he was in that area. He was in the Marcus Mariota, Justin Fields area, which is extremely high scramble rate and extremely high sack rate for pressures last season, a little bit better this season. The reason I don't like that sort of metric, that sort of makeup for a quarterback, is you're just not executing, right? Like if you're scrambling a lot or you're taking sacks a lot, the ball is not leaving your hand on plays. And that's a little troubling. And just anecdotally, when I watch him, some of these sacks I'm taking, I mean, it's not like RG3, Mike Vick levels of being oblivious to the fact that you're about to get trucked and just taking too big of hits. But it's not that far away necessarily either. Big comparisons to Lamar Jackson. I mean, Lamar Jackson was actually pretty good at avoiding sacks generally. I mean, he wasn't great because he was trying to do too much, especially in his final season at Louisville, but I think a little bit better there. McCarthy's interesting. I don't know what to think of these guys, because the problem with McCarthy is, like, I just don't know if there was a guy where I don't know what their ceiling is. It might be someone like McCarthy. You know, I am, like, team ceiling is still there no matter what, but maybe I would look at him a little bit differently than some of these other guys, but not a strong opinion necessarily anywhere there. And then they have Bo Nix, whose projection's not great, and Penix projection is really not good, which is interesting for me. Because I know that I was having a conversation with Matt Waldman the other day, because I'm putting together some quarterback stuff. Hopefully I'll actually get it out before the draft, which is probably more useful than after the draft, about different process. And, you know, there's Cubase here, which is a very strict analytical process. You can see it. You can go back to it. You can investigate it. Waldman actually has a very strict process for what he does. Tons of information, almost information overload. Sorry, Matt. When you're looking at some of these things, but I was able to get some information from him. I'm going to try to, like, do some more testing, because I think it's always the missing link here is how you test these things into the NFL, which is really, really interesting. He likes Penix a lot, so it'd be interesting to see, like, if there are any things in his methodology that I can point to on Penix that would have worked with prior quarterbacks. And I also think, like, in this general overall discussion when we're talking about grading quarterbacks and quarterback evaluation, again, that the Chris Sims of the world, who have done well with some of their projections, like, what's the methodology? I have no clue. I have no clue what the methodology is, other than I watch guy, I watch other guy, I watch third guy, I watch fourth guy, and this is what I think at the end of it. I mean, it was funny because I was kind of locked in pathetically to the 2022 quarterback class, where I was trying to, like, decipher who might be good there. I watched all these JT O'Sullivan videos, and I think he does excellent breakdowns of everything. But I watched all these videos that he did on the different quarterback class. And then at the end, he had, like, a wrap-up video where he was going to rank the guys. I had no clue from watching the videos how he was going to rank them at the end. Like, I thought he was going to go with a totally different ranking after breaking down the videos. And then he got to the end. He's kind of like, well, you know, this guy does some pro type of concepts, and, you know, this guy is kind of this, so this is what I would have it in. It's just, like, the lack of process in that part of it, which I think is kind of the most important part. I mean, these guys are excellent at breaking down the film, not so good at, like, bringing it all together, right? And that's the part that's hard. That's, like, the super forecasters, the Philip Tetlock, if you read that book. Like, experts are bad at predictions, but we're all kind of in the prediction business. We're explicitly in it when it comes to the draft, but we're also implicitly in it when we're ranking quarterbacks, when we're ranking teams, when we're doing all these things, where that's generally telling us, like, what's going to happen the next week, to think about what's going to happen the next week. So these experts are just not very good at it. So, I mean, Chris Sims may have been great, but then again, you know, it's like, if you had an infinite number of monkeys pounding out on a typewriter, eventually one of them would write the complete works of Shakespeare. You know, that whole thing, right? You, you just can't really say. If I can't see the process, I can't see if it's replicable, I can't see how it works out of sample, all those sorts of things, it's really, really tough. But I think, long-winded story short, quarterback class in a nutshell, Williams, everyone else, still think there's upside with these other guys, so I don't mind going for them earlier. I guess I'd lean May over Daniels, but I'm not really like that tied to either one. And if you're going to take those at 2 and 3, I would say go ahead and do so. And if you want to move up to 4 for McCarthy, then it comes into how far do you think you have to move up? How much do you want to give up? Those sorts of things. But when it comes to a team like the Vikings, you know, go at it. Well, let's have it. Okay. Let me dig through some of the comments here to see if I can find anything interesting before moving on to my next talk. Draft talk starting so early. Yeah. I mean, that's another thing about the draft. Again, I don't want to disparage my compatriots in arms who are out there on the front lines doing this draft analysis. However, I don't, like, it does seem a little bit like the amount of brain power and will and grit and everything else that's going into grinding all this tape, making all these rankings, doing everything else, mocking, doing all this stuff. In the end, it gets us somewhere closer to the truth in these consensus big boards, but I don't think it gets it that much closer. And also, as part of this quarterback evaluation research I've been doing, I was looking back at like Mel Kiper and Matt Miller of the world who have long-standing big boards. You notice in these big boards, in these final big boards in particular, they basically move to align with what the draft expectations are. You know, so you're not really like getting a lot of independent, unique analysis there either. Like everyone is influenced by what our expectations are when it comes to the draft, and it's really hard. Like the Cubase rankings are much more bold and unique and taking a stand than the like Mel Kiper or Matt Miller rankings. And again, the Mel Kiper and Matt Miller rankings come with completely devoid of any sort of methodology for how those are put together. So, you know, it's just entertainment. It's all entertainment, basically. And I think you don't want to be maybe caught up in the entertainment side of things as opposed to the actual value-based side of things. Okay. Now let's get into topic number 2 that I wanted to talk about, Brock Bowers. So Bowers is part of a larger discussion, I would say, on draft value, things like that. Elite skill positions versus non-elite skill positions, where they should be drafted. So I wrote a pretty long piece on this one. So there are a few different points to this, and I think it's pretty interesting. And I think you could say there's been a possibility for oversimplification in both directions. This is I'm going to both sides this discussion and make everyone not happy. Although I guess we're more of the nerd side of things here. So if you look at this, depending upon time frame, depending upon sample size, depending upon kind of vibes, everything else, you can make a lot of different cases in a lot of different directions. Now, let me bring up on here for those watching my article on, so you can get a little look in here on Bowers. So when we look at what's happened recently, I think it's fair to point out how poor the results have been recently. And my man, Shiel Kapadia, who, no joke, one of the best out there. He wrote an excellent piece also where he just is more pithy than I am. You know, he's just he gets the points out there in a way that's informed by like thoughtful thinking. Thoughtful analysis. Thoughtful background into what he's doing, but he gets it out there in, you know, bite-sized sorts of ways that's more digestible and for a lot of people, more actionable. There was a joke because, you know, I had a joke last night where Sean Payton, there was this quote that was taken that he said he spent 2 hours learning about analytics the night before, and that was going to help him, you know, increase his batting average when it came to the draft. There were a lot of jokes about that. And, you know, I would say three quarters jokingly, maybe nine tenths jokingly, I said, well, all you really need is 5-10 minutes. Because honestly, if you stuck to your guns on three or four simple principles, and this is Scheel laid out, I think it was seven different principles for what you should do in the draft. If you just stuck to your guns on those, you're getting like 90% of the way there, 85-90% of the way towards not making big mistakes here. But anyway, so Scheel shared this stat about the last 10 years, nine tight ends have been picked in the first round. They have zero all pros, 1,000 yard season, which I assume that is Kyle Pitts. Kyle Pitts went for 1,000 yards, right? His rookie season. One of nine, David Njoku, is with a second contract with the team that drafted him. He says, still to be determined on Kyle Pitts and Dalton Kincaid. I guess you could also, we don't want to over... Tweets are oversimplified. So to say, how dare you put out an oversimplified tweet? I saw some people responding this to be like, oh, this is... bad faith or biased or whatever, because it didn't include the fact that TJ Hockenson got a second contract, but it wasn't with the team that drafted him, because the team that drafted him traded him and they got good trade compensation. I mean, they didn't get a first round pick, but they got a pick swap, second round pick and a pick swap, I believe. So therefore, by not including them, as if he has some sort of agenda. Hey, God, people, it's Twitter. Okay. We're not going to include everything on here. It's just facts. It is fact-based. If you know additional facts, congratulations on you. It's open to interpretation. But the problem here, of course, with this, you don't want to base all your analysis upon this. You're not just closing the book on taking a tight end in the first round, because we still are talking about nine tight ends. So we have this thing in the NFL that becomes a big problem. It's prevalent in all sports. It's a bigger problem in the NFL because of the low sample sizes, the number of positions that we're talking about here. So you split out all these different players. You have few games, you have shorter careers for a lot of these guys. That even we're looking at a 10-year window, and the NFL changes a lot over a 10-year window. I mean, let's think about the changes that went into defensive holding and illegal contact downfield and how they managed that. That's not even that's a little bit longer, but not that much longer than there. Let's think about how the CBA has changed. That was 2011, I believe, was the first year. So yeah, 13 years ago, a little bit longer than 10, but not that much longer than 10. We're starting to get into almost a whole new era. So you have where in order to build up a decent sample size, to even get double digits of first round tight ends, you got to go more than 10 years back. So you have to be able to weigh the changing nature of the game against the small sample size. What can we learn from what we've seen recently, which we put more weight on because it's more recent, but if it's a small sample, does that make it worth more than looking at a longer time frame that digs far into the past but gives us a much more robust sample? And the third thing that I would put in here, maybe I would call this a Rumsfeldian, the unknown unknowns as part of this analysis, is a lot of what ifs in this situation. Even within the last 10 years, I think there's a good case. Actually, maybe it goes more than 10 years, though. I should look up when. Actually, now that I'm thinking about it, I think Gronk was in 2010. I should look this up. Just let me make sure. Was Gronk drafted in 2010? Yes, he was. So a little bit more than 10 years. But still, for a lot of these different numbers, if you go back further than the last 10 years, let's say to 2010 or to 2000, Gronk was technically a second round pick in the NFL draft, but he was the 42nd pick overall. He already had back surgery when he was in college. So there was obviously a risk built into him. If he was the type of prospect who didn't need back surgery, he probably would have been a first round pick. And then he blows apart a lot of these different metrics that we're looking at when it comes to being a first round pick and being a tight end and being all those things. So that's the unknown unknowns sort of situation there, which you always have to think about. Like any range of distributions, any sort of uncertainty calculation that we're basing upon historical examples is going to be lacking in uncertainty, because there's hypotheticals that haven't happened that could potentially happen out of sample in the future that just haven't been part of the, the cosmic mix in our universe to make happen. Okay, but good tweet by Scheel, though. No doubt about it. So this poor track record, we're assuming no one's going to take him, yet still it's looking like the Jets are a likely destination. Although I do think this year, the tide is starting to turn a little bit, I think, out in the sphere of like where he's going to be taken. At least we're talking about Brock Bowers as being probably the 10th pick. I think Adam Schefter says he thinks he's going to go between 10 and 16, as opposed to Kyle Pitts being the number 4 overall pick, being a guy you had to take before a Jamar Chase, being a guy you had to take before a Penei Sewell, being a guy you had to take before, you know, offensive tackles, edge players, wide receivers, who were really that great. We're not getting that from Bowers. And, you know, I don't know where you would place him next to Kyle Pitts as a prospect, but I don't think it's that fundamentally different. He's your generational prospect, right? You know, they talk about like human years versus dog years when it comes to aging. Like generational in NFL terms is 3 seasons, I guess, because we had Kyle Pitts and now we got three more drafts later and we have a new generation for Brock Bowers. I am thinking, and I could be completely wrong on this, as I often am, but I am thinking if the Jets don't take him at 10, and with the chatter out there and people getting smarter and people seeing like recent history, especially Kyle Pitts being a question mark at best recently, I mean, are the Broncos going to take him at 12? I don't know. They got a lot of work to do there. Now, people are pointing to the Colts maybe taking him at 15. I mean, my man, Chris Ballard, does a lot of things wrong. I don't think he's like going for low positional value players. Dude loves to trade back. Loves nothing more than disappointing Colts fans who are watching the draft, the first day of the draft, and then coming away with empty hopes. But multiple picks in the next round, but empty hopes there. So he may move back. We got the Bengals at 18. That's a possibility. Although I think the Bengals, again, like they're going to need to really step up their game if they want to position themselves well in a deep AFC. Is it possible Bowers gets into the 20s this year? I think it's possible. I think there's like some possibility that we see the turning point here, that we see a tipping point when it comes to how much NFL teams are really starting to accept analytics. I mean, what I pointed to on here is that, you know, it takes success. Like it's not only, there's a couple different things that happen. So you have analytics can help with trends, but ultimately the anything that happens on the field has to be implemented by coaches or, you know, GMs in another way, who are former scouts. So most of the time, we're not talking about analytical types. You know, the Kwesi Adofo-Mensahs of the world are the exception and are only coming into play the last couple of years. So by definition, every change that happens, you could credit coaches versus crediting analytics for actually making it happen. There was a discussion talking about soccer. There's a discussion the other day where a tactics soccer blogger was saying, oh, do you think, you know, all these coaches are the ones who are really implementing, taking shorter shots, getting closer, concentrating on higher XG attempts? Like the coaches were the ones doing it. And then Ted Knudsen, who's like a big stats bomb guy, was arguing back, being like, no, we were the ones advocating for this. And I think it's like both people can be truthful, with Ted probably being more on the right side, which is, yeah, Ted Knudsen is not implementing the changes by telling coaches, hey, you should really be doing this. What happens is there's success, you know, in soccer. Maybe it's the form of like a Pep Guardiola or someone like that who's playing that style of soccer. In when it comes to fourth down tries, especially fourth and two tries, I'd say it was 2017 in the success of the Eagles that really made things happen, that accelerated things. And then what you have is the success of what people are seeing is happening gets combined with the institutional analytics knowledge and confidence that you get from that. Those two things come together and you almost start to have very few decision makers who fall outside of believing in the spectrum. You kind of have a wide range of a spectrum. You have certain coaches who start to believe in it, who implement it. As that becomes the thing, the analytics do help in making it uniform. That's what people complain about, like the NBA, the uniform style of play. I mean, three-point shots were going up in the NBA before analytics nerds started telling people, hey, you need to take three-point shots, you know, before they were really getting into it. What happens is the evidence starts being produced. The ownership sees it. Others see it. Coaches see it. Coaches start doing it a little bit more. Particular coaches, they find success. That narrative of success gets mixed with the numbers, and then it becomes a uniform sort of thing. And that's what we saw with fourth downs, which I tried to illustrate here, especially in fourth and two. Fourth and one kind of broke out of a range for how often teams are going for it. Fourth and two just skyrocketed starting in 2017. So I do think when it comes to tight end value, we're kind of getting the combination of the narrative because of how poor tight ends have been recently with the data, with the analytics, which could cause Bowers to fall a bit here. It'll be interesting to see exactly where he falls. You know what I want to look up? Probably should have included this in my article. Can I type in people's names on this? Brock Bowers. So the ESPN, this is an interesting one. Okay, so let me bring this one up. So for ESPN, they have their own draft predictor. So let's share this one. So if you look at the draft predictor for Bowers for where he will go, it kind of goes up between 7 and 16. I think one of the problems with this in the past that ESPN has had, and I think they've lessened in this one, is just not building up enough uncertainty in this. I wouldn't be surprised if this is off. Now, again, I'm probably talking about this a lot, and I'm going to be completely off. Like, it looks as a pick 16, they're saying the chance available is, I don't know what this is. I can't really see. Less than 5%. Maybe it'll be higher. You know, this extends all the way out. In reality, this extends, you know, it shows 16 is the last thing they show. In reality, this extends out to like 20-something, probably, you know? And in reality, it probably starts before pick 7, too. Like, there's some chance it'll go earlier than that. I mean, I think they're limited in what they're showing on here. But the basic gist is that Bowers could end up falling in this one because of how these two things come together. So how do I think about that? How am I gonna do the analysis on this one to think, okay, are we just wrapping it up and saying that's the case? No, I think we got to look a little bit further. So first off, there are two different factors that come into tight end evaluation that everyone's talking about. The first thing is like surplus value. They make less money, tight ends, on their second contracts. So the value that you're getting based upon an elite player versus how much they would make versus their NFL contract as a rookie, you're not getting as much surplus value. I think there's way too much focus on that, honestly, because when we're talking about Bowers in particular, like we're talking about him becoming like a Kelsey or becoming like a Kittle or becoming someone like that. Does anyone think George Kittle, whose cap hit I believe this year is $12 million and change, that is how much he's worth? No, he's worth a lot more than that. Tight ends don't make enough money. Most of them make the right amount, and then the few at the top don't make nearly enough. So I think that's lesser of a point. I think the bigger point is that it's really difficult to rank order and assess and pick the right one. And that's why I'm kind of like, let's just wait and figure out who has an ability, who has the traits to be good, and then get them at a better take. I have a whole thing on here about tight ends and why they make less money. It's the franchise tag. It's calculated on 5 players. There aren't that many tight ends. There are barely any elite tight ends. They get injured all the time. So, you know, that's why the franchise tag is $15 million versus almost $30 million for wide receivers. And how that holds down everyone's salary, and it becomes a vicious cycle of continuing to hold down people's salaries in the future. So there's like some argument that actually if you hit on a tight end on your second contract, you're getting better value than you're getting in these other guys. So again, when we look at the recent tight ends who still have a chance of doing something, we got basically nothing so far in terms of major accolades. We have some decent seasons from Njoku, from Hawkinson, from Pitts. That's about it. You got Hayden Hurst. You got Noah Fant in here. OJ Howard, just like pretty big bus there. Evan Ingram, he's been whatever. He's been okay. Kincaid, to be determined. So you go back further, and it's still pretty problematic. If you look at all first-round tight ends going back to 2000, you only have 3 first-team All-Pro selections. Vernon Davis once, Dallas Clark once. And are we like, how much is Clark a product of Peyton Manning, right? And then Jeremy Shockey once, as a rookie, I believe, who's first team all pro. And then Greg Olsen was second team all pro twice. That's it. Oh, actually, Vernon Davis, sorry. He was only second team All-Pro. He was never first team All-Pro. That's it for all these different guys who were selected. So we're talking about 18 different tight ends who were selected between 2014 and 2000. That's it. So again, not looking good. A lot of evidence saying, oh, you had Jimmy Graham was one of the best players in the world for a while. He was a third round pick. Gronkowski was a second round pick, although he could have been a first round pick. Those guys are like eating up all the AP all pros. You have Antonio Gates, who's a UDFA, who's one of the best players out there, who should be in the Hall of Fame, by the way. Let's get Antonio Gates in the Hall of Fame. I know he didn't make it last year. So that's your evidence against it. Now, this is still like decent evidence, but not like I'm still going to go back further. I know it may be absurd to say we're looking earlier than the year 2000, but I think we can get something from it, right? So if we go back even further, we start hitting some jackpots here. 1997, Tony Gonzalez, 13th pick overall. In many people's minds, the greatest tight end ever. I mean, I lean towards Gronk for ceiling and kind of extraordinary play versus TG, but you could go either way. I got to represent, though. Went to Cal. Actually, went to Cal at the same time as me. That shows you how old I am. Hall of Fame, 6-time first-team All-Pro, 4-time second-team All-Pro. Yeah, I mean, with the Cal, with Tony Gonzalez, he's, you know, making millions of dollars commentating and a Hall of Fame football player, and I'm here streaming to hundreds of people. Keith Jackson, I mean, still you had a gap here. So again, like, even if you looked at this one, you said 1990 to 1997, if Tony Gonzalez didn't exist, then everyone would have been a bust. But he's a massive, massive, massive hit. Like, these few chances, which may or may not be part of your sample, make such a big difference. So Keith Jackson, 3-time first team All-Pro. Whoa, Nelly, let me tell you about Keith Jackson. 3-time first team All-Pro, 1-time second team All-Pro. Go back a few years even more. Junior Miller, don't even know who that is, but he was a second team All-Pro. Congrats. Kellen Winslow, Hall of Famer. Ozzie Newsome, Hall of Famer. And then you go all the way back to Mike Ditka, Hall of Famer. There's even a guy missing in here who was technically the 19th pick overall back in 1963, John Mackey, the MFN Mackey Award, as Evan Silva would say, was named after him. And of course, he's a Hall of Famer and everything else. And he's a 19th pick overall, so technically not a first rounder because the NFL was so small at that point. But you know what I mean. And you got a handful of other guys in here. So all of a sudden, this very, very old cohort, because of a few massive hits, mostly. I mean, it's mostly because of like Tony Gonzalez and these Hall of Famers, Winslow, Newsome, Ditka. Because of these guys, you're starting to average like one All-Pro season per pick, whereas it would have been you need 3-4 picks just to get one All-Pro season in these earlier cohorts. So, you know, 5 of the 9 Hall of Famers are kind of first-round picks, and then I'm including Mackey in there, who wasn't technically a first-round pick, but kind of a first-round pick. So, like, what's going on here? Has the game changed that much? That's one possibility, which I think is, maybe. Are we opening up more opportunity for later draft picks? That's possible. Shifting demands of the position, it's more of a receiving position where there's just a lot of guys who could potentially do that versus receiving and blocking. Yeah, that's probably part of it. Small sample noise. And I think like the first one needs to get a lot more credit or a lot more fixation than the rest of them even. I think you can explain away a lot of the stuff through the other ones, but I think there just is this noise in recent products and recent prospects that we can't fully get away from. So what I tried to do is I looked at these guys and tight ends, the production they provide, receiving, and compared them to receivers. And what we start to find is, you know, they can't really stack up to wide receivers. And even if you give tight ends additional credit, and I'm giving them like Kelce, I'm giving them Kittle, I'm giving them Dallas Goedert, I'm giving them a bunch of guys that they don't deserve because they're not first rounders. Even if you throw these guys in here as like a first rounder type of prospect, you're just not getting the upside. Again, you're getting like not a totally dissimilar mean outcome, but you're not getting the upside outcome. And the upside outcomes are what we care about, is what we really care about. So they can't really compare to a first-round receiver. I don't care what they do. Blocking is not making up the difference. You have lots of first-round receivers over 1,000 yards, very few tight ends. It's a little bit closer when it comes to touchdowns, but still more upside when it comes to receivers. Now, when you get to second round, more upside for receivers. you know, still your mean outcome is lower for tight ends, but it gets close. And for touchdowns, you're actually looking a little bit better with the tight end. So I think this is kind of the range. Long story short, this is kind of the range. Second round, elite prospect. And this is what, you know, you need to connect together. It's not just say, don't draft Brock Bowers in the first round, but then where should you take him and why should you take him there? And just quickly to close out the Brock Bowers discussion, to steel man it a little bit, one of the, I won't say better analyses, but, you know, one that at least tries to tackle the question of Brock Bowers is Nate Tice wrote something for Yahoo. Let me bring that up. And again, we'll try to steel man here. We'll look and we'll say, okay, let's look at what Nate wrote here. And do we need something? Do we need something to be gaining from here? And I think basically what it comes down to is he's different. Okay, well, that's pretty similar. Is he actually built like a tight end? Is he worthy of the hype? And all these different things really wraps up with the big point. And I think this is when you have to be able to like connect it back to, well, values. Is draft a player, not the position? So don't think of him as a tight end. Think of him as a power slot, a true adjuster type player. I'm not sure I know what that means, but I know what a power slot means. I think it just means like a big slot. He can be quick. He can quickly be effective at the next level as a power slot. Now, does the data tell us that power slots are quickly effective at the next level? I don't know, but you know, he's claiming it. So he says he has a grade as a top five player in the class because of his movement ability, because of this power slottedness. But the question is, and I think this is how you have to, you can't just say, well, he's not a tight end. He's a power slot and he's a top five player. Like, well, why is a power slot, a great power slot, a top five player? That's where it kind of falls apart for me. You know, I feel like 90% of what I could do to inspect people's opinions is just to say why at the end. You know, if you could, if like this analysis, if Nate Tice says like, he's not like other tight ends, he's a power slot, he can do all these things, he can match up against defensive backs and linebackers, he can do that. So therefore he's a top five pick. And I'd just be like, okay, well, why? Like, how did you end up with top five pick based upon that? Or how did you end up on top five player? And it's probably crickets at that point, because it's just like, well, I'm just thinking about other players and then I'm thinking about him and I'm thinking that he's higher than those other players. So like, if you step out of it, and I think this is how I would kind of critique some of these things, is say, okay, let's imagine you had a wide receiver who was a power slot, as you called him. I don't know. Again, I mean, is power have to do with blocking? Big slot, whatever. A big slot wide receiver. Where would they go in the NFL draft? An elite big slot wide receiver. They wouldn't go in the first round. Okay, that's like the whole thing. That was like the Justin Jefferson, can he play outside of the slot or not, is being important. You know, spoiler alert, yes, he can play out of the slot. Having that positional availability, there's just a lot more guys who can play in the slot versus can't play in the slot. So it's just a less valuable role, being someone who's in the slot versus not. Now, I know Travis Kelce is amazing, is awesome. Yeah, if you hit that elite outcome. But even still, you know, you have more options to replace Travis Kelce in the slot if he's not available than you do to replace a great wide receiver on the outside if they're not available. Now, that the wide receivers have lost some of their value over time, those prototype number one guys. But if you said, like, okay, let's imagine their name's not Brock Bowers. Let's imagine the position isn't tight end. Let's imagine it's a wide receiver who run blocks sometimes. And he's a power slot, like, where would you take him as a prospect? You don't know. You don't know he's great, right? Like Deebo Samuel. Was Deebo Samuel a first-round pick? No, he wasn't. So why would he be a top-five pick? You know, I think it's just pretty easy to, like, take their own words, feed them back to them, and just say why. And then you're, and then there's an idea of like, oh yeah, well maybe the process here needs to be fleshed out a little bit more. Maybe we need to be thinking about this on like a little bit more critically than just saying, here are my feelings of where this guy should be. And here's what my feelings are based on. And my feelings tell me he should be here. And the things that are I'm basing my feelings on are valid, so therefore he should be here. It's kind of a weird sort of thing. I was watching another good analyst, Mina Kimes, was talking to someone about whether, like, where do you take Bowers? And it's just like, well, I'm more confident in Bowers versus some of these receivers in a certain range. And again, I would just say, why? Like, what makes you more confident? We've seen all these busts at tight end, right? We've seen tons of busts at tight end. Like, what makes you more confident in them? And, like, is that even the real important thing? The confidence, or is the upside the important thing? Like, if you hit a Justin Jefferson, CeeDee Lamb sort of outcome in that same range, middle of the draft, like, isn't that better than, even if you're not confident, if you have a chance at that, then the chance of the most likely like outcomes you're going to get where you're going to say, I have to match like two human beings on the earth so far in like a George Kittle, who's still injured all the time. And or a Travis Kelce, maybe one person on the earth right now who's playing football. I think just asking why for a lot of these things, because again, we have feelings, which then based upon opinions on things, they reinforce each other. And then they kind of come together in people's brains as if it's a formulaic way of justifying something. But the reality is it doesn't really add up once you look at their component parts and what they're telling you versus other sorts of evidence. All right, I've been jabbering on. That was way too long, but I was jabbering on here. Let me take some questions because I gotta figure out what the heck's going on here. Let me start. Okay, put some into the Q&A. Actually, repeat and put Q&A on there if you want something in the live stream. Let me grab the few that I had on a late sort of thing here. Okay, I'm gonna go to Twitter first. How would you evaluate the Jordan Love pick? I guess retrospectively. What was your opinion back then? Okay. I should go into Twitter to see what my opinion is, to see if I wrote anything. Let me look to see if I wrote anything, because I think I know what my opinion was. But this is always a good check, because guess what? Your boy is just as biased as everyone else. Let me say, until what was the – so it was 2020, right? So until 2020 – 06, maybe we'll go all the way to 0630. Okay, let's see. So I'll just put love. Okay, unfortunately, the word love just itself comes up. I might not have anything, honestly. I got some Jalen Hurts stuff in here. Yeah, I don't really. Okay. Oh, I get it. Okay. The Packers are benching Rodgers, starting Love, and drafting Andre Williams' clone. I don't really have anything. Okay, thanks. It's probably good that I don't have anything. Oh, no, I do say the only way they figure out that Love pick makes sense is potentially trading Rodgers after the 2021 season. Ooh, I'm close on that. 2022 season. So, cap hit would be manageable considering Love's rookie contract. That's interesting that I said that because... like, you know, they re-upped Rodgers and made it not manageable. And then they still traded him. Well, actually, I didn't realize it was so early this pick happened. Okay, this is not great podcasting. I apologize here. Okay, this is all I got. There's nothing I can really find on Jordan Love. But okay, I think that my opinion on the time was that it was actually better than like the CJ Dillon pick. Oh, here's a good one. It's a good snarky one. Packers drafted Jordan Love to teach Aaron Rodgers how to not fear interceptions. that's a good one. But anyway, I didn't really have much opinion. I thought he was maybe like not the greatest talent, but as I've gone further, I was probably too pedantic at that point in time about like not drafting quarterbacks unless they fit some particular mold. Whereas the guy's got talent, it's the end of the first round. Well, why the hell not? So, but I did say last offseason that I thought he probably wasn't going to be good because, you know, whatever, I'm just playing the odds. I mean, I said he wasn't probably wasn't going to be good. I said Sam Howell probably wasn't going to be good. And I said Desmond Ridder probably wasn't going to be good. Now, Jordan Love had the best chance of being good because of the former first round pick, but, you know, still the odds were against him. And hey, he looks like he's doing all right. So, you know, I was wrong there. Well, I wasn't wrong because I said probably, but you know what I mean. Okay, next question. Football stuff, blah, 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 blah. Do you think teams, meaning the Bears, are overvaluing Caleb, even media consensus too? Says with JJ and the Vikings will probably have the best career, as we often see with quarterbacks drafted after one. No, I mean, I think the Bears are pretty good. So he's already assuming JJ McCarthy is going to the Vikings, and will he have a better career there? Because I guess he's not being drafted by the worst team in the NFL. But you know what? The Bears aren't the worst team in the NFL. Bears have a lot. They got a lot going on there, especially the number nine pick also going on there. They had a defense which will regress from the second half of last season, but that was like what built up some of the Justin Fields hype, was the fact that they were, I believe, the number one defense in the NFL, not schedule adjusted, number one defense in the NFL by EPA per play over the second half of the season. So probably not going to completely fall off a cliff there. If you, let's say you get average defense, you got DJ Moore there, you got, you know, drafted a tackle last year, maybe build up there, maybe get another receiver. You got some guys. Hey, you might be cooking over there. So I don't think Caleb's in a bad spot at all. And like I said before, I think it's fair to put Caleb a tier above everyone else. High, high, high degree of uncertainty in this, but you know, whatever. I'm still willing to put him in a tier above everyone else. All right, what are the comments we got here? Let's view the comments from the site. Okay. Still shocking to me how far the NFL is with the use of information compared to baseball, even basketball. I believe the Vikings are the only team whose GM wasn't a former scout or former player. Yeah, I guess Howie Roseman did some scouting, maybe. I don't see positional value in the draft affecting selections until teams start hiring the Harvard grads. Okay, well, I guess that was more of a comment than a question there. I would say, well, not related to this comment, but I'm glad that we're actually opening things up beyond the Harvard grads. No disrespect to Harvard, you know, the Stanford of the East, as I like to call it. They're, you know, you got some mover and shakers coming out of there, but I think we're in a better space with the NFL generally, where you have decision makers making hires when it comes to analytics who don't know anything. They just like look at a resume, they see Harvard, and they're like, okay, well, I guess I'm going to pick the guy from Harvard and not the guy from, you know, Cal Poly Pomona. But now, because of the and big props to Mike Lopez and the Big Data Bowl and opening that up and allowing people to show their work and present in front of the NFL, now we got lots of people being hired from lots of different places on something a little bit more solid than just based upon resume. But again, I digress. Okay, second comment here. I think we got an actual comment. I really enjoyed your Brock Bowers article and was wondering if you could quickly apply the same rationale to Kyle Hamilton's selection, who was picked in a similar range Bowers is being projected. From the draft curves, we know tight end and safety don't offer surplus value with the top 15 selection. I don't follow closely, but it seems Hamilton is a good player. But where exactly should he have been drafted? Okay, so safety and tight end, similar tiering, similar curve, like draft surplus value curvedness, but I would say it's based upon different factors. It's those two different things that I talked about before. One factor being that you have the surplus value. So the surplus value is like, again, that argument is kind of overstated for tight ends, or the negative of it is overstated for tight ends, because like the Kittles and Kelsey's of the world are not making enough money. So to say that that's their value, what their NFL contract is incorrect. But it's really, really difficult to find the rank order of these guys and find them. I would say for safety, it's a little bit of the opposite, or at least the proportions are different. For safety, it really is these guys are not getting paid that much. That you can find them, there is not only replacement level, but NFL average level, maybe even above NFL average sort of level that you can buy for fairly cheaply, not only via trade, not only by drafting later, but also especially in free agency. Like, there are guys available in free agency where you don't have to break the bank. And there have been big, big moves. I think those are generally kind of poor, like to pay up for safeties. But like, you can find some pretty good safeties in free agency. And the other thing I would say about safety is, and this comes into play for Kyle Hamilton too, as far as who he is going forward. We'll see. Coverage positions, and safety is going to be mostly about coverage for me. You know, run defense matters. All that stuff matters. You know, don't get me wrong. Football guys, don't yell at me. But coverage is the more important thing. And coverage for a player is not as sticky season to season within the same system, with the same coaches, with the same teammates for the most part. Obviously, teammates can shift a lot season to season. It's especially bad going to a new team. So, like, what is this player worth? Part of what this player is worth is, like, what are they worth in a kind of universal sort of context? What they're worth to your team is obviously a big part of it in your particular system, but also whether they're worth on a universal basis, which kind of establishes a market for them. So for Hamilton, I would say that, like, your ability to get a big upsized elite few seasons early on are probably higher at safety than at tight end some of the times, just because we have so few tight ends that we can say have hit. It's just really like a needle in a haystack sort of situation. But I would say the tight end could end up being more valuable, especially onto the second contract where safeties aren't making as much money. So the Hamilton pick is interesting because, remember, Hamilton, this is another one where things shifted as the offseason moved. There were my man, PFF Mike Renner. I remember I got mad at him and sent him a note about the fact that he was doing a podcast early in the offseason where he did Tape Bro 101, pet peeve of mine, where he said, you know, all people say Kyle Hamilton, you know, because of positional value isn't worth it. Well, I say, watch the tape. That was like, oh my God, you almost could not put together a sentence that's not going to trigger me more than that. But even he might have come off of it. But there was a lot of like, Kyle Hamilton's a top five player talk. And then he was falling. Teams are trading up to get those wide receivers, which was interesting because I think even the Ravens were thinking about trading back, but the phone stopped ringing after, so Jameson Williams was the last one that was taken, or was it Olave? Anyway, after London, Olave, and Williams were gone, the phone stopped ringing. They were sitting there. It sounded like they were willing to trade back, and they decided at that point, what was it, 12th, 13th overall or something like that, to go ahead and turn in the card on Kyle Hamilton. I wouldn't have done it, I don't think. And I know after the fact it looks worse to say I wouldn't have done it. I probably wouldn't have done it there. But again, they were kind of like sitting around and figuring out what to do. I think the Eagles also jumped above them to grab, who is it, Jalen Carter? I might be misremembering this. So there was that too, where like, who knows where the Ravens would have gone if not for that. Actually, we'll go up to number nine. Actually, that's not Jalen Carter. Sorry. Well, why am I? I'm getting their guys mixed up. Who am I mixing up here? It's not Jalen Carter. It was Jordan Davis. Sorry, God, I always get those two confused. So yeah, Jordan Davis. So they jumped up to go right. That's what happened. So they jumped up to 13 to go right before Kyle Hamilton. I think they thought the Ravens were going to draft Jordan Davis. So at 14, that's where they were. It's not bad. I mean, it's funny if you look at some of these picks that happened after the Ravens. You got a guard going next to the Texans. Kenyon Green? Whatever, it's fine. You have another guard going to the Chargers a couple picks later. You got Dotson and Burks at wide receiver, who have not really panned out that well. Trevor Penning picks up a lot of offensive fouls. That's not bad. Kenny Pickett. Ooh, and then you got Trent McDuffie. So eventually you got McDuffie there. So like, let's just say here, let's just play devil's advocate and to make my point, which is not a fair thing to do, and to, you know, selection bias, confirmation bias here. What if the Ravens would have taken Trent McDuffie, the next defensive back, instead of Kyle Hamilton? Hey, you know, I guess McDuffie actually got traded for not that much here, and what his value is a little bit questionable, but hey, that's another way that could have gone there. So it's fine. But it was weird to see the Ravens take Hamilton and Linderbaum, where it was like they waited, they didn't trade up, they got them at good values according to the draft board, even though I don't think that really matters because all these people had Kyle Hamilton ridiculously high on their big boards. And then they eventually came down as they realized, hey, wait a second, this guy has no chance of being a top 10 pick when we thought he might be. So we're going to adjust all of our big boards because of that, even though they're not supposed to be doing that, right? They're supposed to be giving us their opinion on how good these players are. So anyway, long story short, it goes to like a lot of these situations when it comes to teams not doing what I think they should be doing, but they're a smart team like the Ravens. It's like, yeah, I wouldn't have done it, but it's not the worst, right? And that's how I'd probably say it for Hamilton. Okay. Next question. How should the mid-round QB needy teams, Vikings, etc., think about the question of trading up to 4 or 5 for QB 4 versus staying put, trading down for QB 5 or QB 6? I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, for the fact that I think that it really is kind of like Caleb Williams and everyone else, like what's the difference between, let's just say, JJ McCarthy? Right? Everyone's talking about him. I don't think Bo Nix or Penix are in the same area. So let's just say you can get JJ McCarthy. You can give up another first rounder and maybe more. I don't know what the going rate is for that. Probably more to move up if you're the Vikings to get JJ McCarthy versus staying put and being able to get Bo Nix. I don't know. I guess I would do it. I mean, again, like, you only live once in some of these sort of situations. When it comes to quarterback, you know, I don't subscribe to the logically false theory that you can never pay too much if they hit. I like that one because it's like, no, you can still pay too much. Like if you give up every draft pick that you have for the next 3 drafts. Actually, you can do 4 drafts the minute the draft starts. You can go 4 drafts into the future. If you gave up all of your draft picks for the next 4 drafts other than your first pick, that would be too much to pay, probably, even if the quarterback hits. So if you're getting a market rate for it, yeah, you know, I could go either way. It all depends on like the evaluations on this, but I do think there probably is a teardrop, it seems like, between these, which may justify paying up when you definitely need the quarterback. So I could go either way on this. If you like Penix or someone like that, you know, maybe you could go back instead. I wouldn't be against that. But let me just pull up the old Vikings roster right now. It's not exactly like a winning roster. I know it would be apocryphal to even think about like Justin Jefferson, but, you know, could they trade him? That would be interesting. That would be an interesting move and really load up for next year. Sam Darnold. I forgot they have Darnold. Darnold lovers he'll be really good. Sam Darnold will be really good for like 3 weeks. He's either really, really good at the end of the season, which he did his first couple of years, and then people have hope over the summer, or he's really, really good at the beginning of the season, like he was with the Panthers. And then he was really, really good at the end of the season when he came back in for the Panthers, I think, in that second year. So he's like, he gives you little spurts of hope. Maybe he'll be really, really good to start the season and give you that spurt of hope there. So they probably got to do something. So what the hell? Let's move up. Let's go get some JJ in our lives. All right. And do we have any more? Okay. No, that's it for the website. Now let me go to anyone in the YouTube here. Is there anyone on YouTube that's dropped Q&A? Okay. I see a couple here. Okay. Let's get to these. And then, didn't know Ozzy was a first rounder. Yeah, 20 something. Good to have you back. Thank you. Okay, let's get to the Q&A. I'm sorry, I'm just reading through some of these. Okay, I'm still doing work on running backs. I recall an article Maybe I'll bring it up. You know, you can do the show thing. Still doing work on running backs. I recall an article, 40 receptions per game. No, I'm not. But who's the guy? Who's the little guy? There's one guy who I'm in love with for running backs. I had him up earlier. He went to like Connecticut or something. Was it Massachusetts? I can't remember now. Do you guys know what I'm talking about? Lobby? Here it is. Dylan Laub. Look at this guy. He looks like, like a mini Christian McCaffrey out there. He's like 28 years old or so. He looks like he's 38 years old. But hey, let's go draft him. Let's go draft him in the fifth round. Okay, rather than going for anyone else. So that's what I'll say there. Okay, Q&A. Jason Fitzgerald. Okay, first of all, anyone who's not listening to Jason Fitzgerald, please do. He's my inspiration here. He did a three and a half. I got to move up on the screen here. He did a 3.5-hour podcast on his last one. I did not listen to the whole thing. He starts talking about Jets, and you get him talking about Jets, and you get him like 3 or 4 IPAs in and forget about it. But he had the funniest Stephon Diggs. I think he called it the gold standard. Stephon Diggs has been doing the gold standard for manipulating NFL teams. And I'll give it to him there. And I don't think it's a calculated sort of thing. I think it's like literally Stephon Diggs is just kind of an asshole. So it's just what he always does. There's a funny video for the Vikings where they say, who would you not want to date your sister? And like every single player on the Vikings said Diggs. And it wasn't like they were like, let me think about it. Diggs. They were just like, oh, Diggs, of course. You know, so like, I don't think he's doing it on purpose, but like he's a master. That's what the guys, what you do is you sign a contract, you get a huge signing bonus. You talk yourself out of town. That signing bonus is gone. So that sunk cost is not attached to your contract anymore. You go into your new team and you say, hey, I want to renegotiate this contract. My salary, look at it. It's a pittance, even though you just got a signing bonus like 2 years ago of $35 million. Let's move it up. You guys didn't pay for this. Like, let's move me up. And then they move you up. It's amazing how these teams can be. Okay. Anyway, so props to Jason. Follow his podcast, OTC podcast. Jason Fitzgerald has mentioned that truly elite players at premium positions rarely become free agents. Interestingly, elite tight ends don't get to free agency. Do you think that impacts their draft position? No, I don't think it impacts their draft position because there's just so few of the elite ones. And that's kind of what we're talking about. But you're right that they are. And this is why I don't put as much of a basis on the contract, the surplus value thing. And then there's another thing when it comes to safeties. Remember we were having the safety versus tight end discussion. Safeties plentiful in free agency. Tight ends plentiful in free agency, but not great ones. You know, not great ones because they're just like a whole different breed than the other ones. They're almost like so dissimilar as to not be the same position sometimes. These guys can be so much more valuable. So they ain't hitting free agency, which lets you know their second contracts are pretty good deals for their teams. So that should theoretically, and I thought about this idea. I remember, I think it was during the TJ Hockenson era when he was being drafted. I was like, you know, I float around the idea of playing around and like flipping the surplus value thing on its head and saying, well, actually, maybe you could draft these guys early because they are values on their second contracts, which should push them up draft boards because of the surplus value you're getting on their next contract. But the reality is it's only for like a couple of guys. Like even Mark Andrews, if you can stay healthy, right? That's another problem. They don't stay healthy, these tight ends. You're blocking guys bigger than you and your back gives out and your shoulders and everything gives out. You get concussed. Or you're going over the middle of the field and you have these defensive backs who can't go high on you, who are just taking out your knees constantly, at least the hip drop tackle. Remember when Andrews went out on that last year? Like that was a killer for tight ends because like the reason they do the hip drop tackle and especially why it's different than rugby is like, it's the best way of just stopping someone in their tracks, especially when they're bigger than you. You know, they don't fall forward. So like in the NFL where you care about another half a yard, they're near that first down marker. You care about another yard and a half. To get there, you want them just to go straight down. And that's the most effective way to do it is to hip drop them to take them down rather than get on for a ride and move a yard or two forward and fall down. So maybe that'll help tight ends stay healthy. But that's another problem with tight ends, that they don't stay healthy. So it should impact their draft status positively. It doesn't really have that much of an impact, though, because, again, you have to hit the elite guy, and that's been so difficult to do. Okay. More questions. Dylan Lobb, I like that. They jumped right in here. Did I miss a Q&A? Oh, I did miss some here. How did I skip past these? Okay, again, great podcasting on my part here. Okay, Q&A. Because it came up, how true do you think it is that Pitts has not had success because of usage? People seem to take for granted that he's been held back by Smith with minimal evidence, in my opinion. Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. It's one of those, again, this type of thinking that we're talking about, that you and I have on this, and how we differ from other people on this, is it's kind of like using models generally. You know, we say, in my favorites, one of my favorite lines, which it's hackneyed, I believe is the correct terminology at this point, is that all models are wrong. I can't even get it right. All models are wrong, but some are useful. So again, it's like our mental model when it comes to players, at least my mental model when it comes to players, is when they're not performing, my mental model is, however much people are saying, well, the problem is the coaching, the problem is the system, the problem is this, the problem is that, especially if they're like a great prospect, you know, like how many quarterbacks where people would say like, oh, David Carr, you know, he could have been great if it wasn't for taking all these sacks early. I mean, I don't know. Like he was still playing in the league for 10 years and getting sacked all the time. Like how much do you need? How long are we willing to extend this, this rope to them to say, you know, that they need more chances. They need second, third chance. So my mental model is player not good. Not as good as we think. So if everyone is focused on the coaching, helping them, it's probably a thing, but I would always lean towards it being less of a thing than what people think, because people are going to naturally overestimate it. Now, sometimes you're going to be wrong. Again, it's not this mental model is incorrect. I'm not going to have the perfect exact calibration on Kyle Pitts to diagnose in my mental model whether or not people's system, Arthur Smith, who they loved, by the way, before, who I'm sure when Kyle Pitts was drafted, they were like, oh, Arthur Smith was going to take him to, you know, the next level. I guess not the next level because he's already was in the NFL, but you know what I mean. My lean would be to say probably overstating it. Sometimes they're correct, though. Sometimes they're understating. Sometimes Kyle Pitts will now end up being a five-time, first-time Pro Bowler. But most often, and that's why it's useful, you know, we'll end up being right most of the time. Q&A. If you're still willing to answer, humor me with your take on this statement. Mark Andrews will likely have a long career because tight ends have long careers. See Gonzalez, Kelsey, Witten. Maybe, you know, that's an interesting thing where I'm kind of tangent going off. I'm thinking out loud here. So I remember a wide receiver study on career length, and it was a little like the results were that big wide receivers trailed off more. And small wide receivers, now this is going back to the big versus small wide receiver battles in fantasy spaces circa 2014, you know, for the real OGs out there who were out there on the streets at that point in time. So big wide receivers fell off, small wide receivers didn't fall off. That might go against like some of our thinking here. And when you're thinking about tight ends, I think anecdotally, as you mentioned here, Gonzalez, Kelsey, Witten. I mean, Gonzalez and Witten, I would like to have seen what their 40 times were at the end of their careers. Kelsey's getting there. Kelsey's getting in that ballpark where I don't think he ain't moving. He ain't moving like he used to down the seam, you know? So now that you mention that, it makes me think, you know what? Maybe like the whole wide receiver, big wide receivers decline faster than small wide receivers had nothing to do with big or small. It had to do with like big wide receivers, at least in that era in particular, were the prototype X wide receivers playing on the outside, and the small wide receivers were playing on the inside. Where do tight ends play? They play on the inside. Maybe your career can be much longer on the inside, where you just got to go up there and do a little shimmy. You know, you box people out, you use your wily veteran tricks on there. You're mind meld with the quarterback to know what you're doing. You're like the guy posting up. It's like you go to the pickup game. You know, the old guy who has like the knee wraps on there and headband or something like that, who's just like knows how to just post guys up and score, even though coming up and down the court they can barely move. Maybe it's one of those types of situations. Maybe that's what those numbers were telling us, is that like the slot little receivers were lasting longer because that's just an extended window for what you can do things in that sort of area. So I kind of do like that. Although Andrews is a little bit different. Andrews isn't much of a shimmy shake guy. He does get down the field a little bit more, especially in the past. Lamar Jackson had used the tight end and Andrews in the middle of the field to get down the field a bit more because he was fairly ineffective, honestly, throwing to the outside of the receivers. So we'll see. He got hit by the hip drop. But tight ends generally have shorter careers and they get injured more. So that's where it all falls apart. Interesting. He's a taller guy too. Whereas Gonzalez, Witten, like what's TG? Let's see. Well, actually, let me look at the height. So I'm not just talking out of my ass here. As I do. So Mark Andrews, 6'5". That seems pretty tall. But is Travis Kelce 6'5"? Sure seems like he's not as tall. He does say 6'5". Maybe they are as tall. I don't know. He plays smaller for me, though, for some reason. Same with Winton. Same with what was Tony Gonzalez? I remember Tony Gonzalez, you know, he played basketball at Cal when I was there, too. And that just kind of shows you, like, how good of athletes these tall basketball players are. Or how skilled they are versus NFL players. Because, you know, Tony Gonzalez was not very good at basketball. I mean, he was good for college. But he was not going to hang. He was not going to be able to hang in the NBA. But he's, you know, greatest tight end ever. 6'5" for him, too. Wow. Okay. I don't know. Well, there goes that whole theory. That's what you come here for, that type of analysis. The Bears have a very nice roster. I couldn't disagree with that comment more. Okay. Yeah. No. So we're in agreement. I like that. Is it historically better to draft with the strength of the class, taking the fourth tackle over the top defensive tackle if it's a strong tackle class? Good question. Don't know. Don't know the answer to that. You probably want to look at tiering. Like, I have both of those, especially if the defensive tackle is a pass rusher. I have both of those as being a top tier position. I think that the offensive tackle is still the most difficult position to get. Or the most difficult non-quarterback position to get in free agency, probably. We're talking about that high level. And like filling in, like you can't, with defensive tackle and with edge rusher, you can kind of like Frankenstein something. You can bring players in and out and use them as specialists more, right? Like small guys, small edge rushers who you wouldn't necessarily want to have on there on first down and third and short. You can bring them on there in passing downs. Whereas offensive tackles like play every single play. Joe Thomas famously, you know, played almost his entire career until the end, not missing a single snap. So I probably would lean tackle, but not necessarily because of the tiering questions. Hamilton was supposed to be a top five pick. Yeah, I mean, that was like early in the year. And I think most people were pretty hip to the fact that he fell. Actually, that's an interesting question. Okay, I got to check myself here. Let's look at our Jack Lichtenstein, Jack Lick 10.com. Check it out. LICH. Let's go back in time. Let's see where his consensus big board. Remember, the consensus big board is kind of always behind the times, right? So let's go back to the consensus big board for Kyle Hamilton. Number six. Okay. So he was number six, but look at this. I mean, you know, TDN, NFL.com. I guess USA number one. I mean, come on, guys. Come on. I realized it was a bad quarterback draft, but you got Aiden Hutchinson there, for God's sake. You had Sauce. Wait, what happened to Stingley? Was actually seven. Stingley was lower. For some reason, I thought Stingley was like considered to be a better prospect than Sauce was. But what's interesting about this one, yeah, I think they're behind the curve. So he eventually fell to six. He might have been even higher earlier in the cycle for the consensus big board, according to this. And I think most people kind of recognized that he was going to go a bit later, but he was going to be, you know, the value. He was going to be the value guy, the positional value versus value guy. Yeah, okay. I'm sorry. I'm reading over you guys is trying to give me answers as I'm just missing things left and right. Is there any more Q&A? Okay, here's one more Q&A here. Okay. What do you think the Packers should do in the first round? I could see them going either cornerback or O-line. Okay, this is probably... Okay, I'm going to... Full disclosure, this is probably like the worst aspect of my analysis since I know nothing. So let's look. Let's try to do this though. We'll go through it, and I'll expose myself as the fraud that I am. Okay, so the Packers. Where are we now? Pick 25. Okay, so let's just talk. Let's go macro here. Let's go macro. Second half of the first round. Like, what do we want to be looking at? And I'm a pretty firm believer that. Teams, it's funny, all these like NFL analysts are always like, best player available, best player available, best player available. And then you look at their mock drafts and they're just like, need here, need there. They're just checking boxes. They think, oh, you know, the Jets brought in two 35-year-old offensive tackles. So don't need that. Like, let's give them Brock Bowers. I mean, come on, dude. Like, depth is extremely underrated, extremely important. So cornerback would be an ideal position in that range of the draft. Tier two positions start to really pick up there. Now, if you could find a tackle, you might be interested in. If you could find an edge rusher, you might be interested in. If you can find it a pass rushing defensive tackle, which would be the tier one guys, that's fine. Cornerback, that's where I would go there. Now, if you're talking about O-line, let's look at the old depth chart for the Packers. If you really are confident in a tackle there, maybe you could go there. But let's see. Is that what we're worried about here? Yeah, I guess it probably is what we're worried about. Now that I'm looking at this. Yeah, it probably is what you're worried about. I mean, guard is like more in that range. But even guard, give me the second or third round for guard. I know, you can get a good guard in the first round. It's fine, but... No, yeah. I mean, cornerback is an ideal position. And then wide receiver. I guess people think that they might have an okay wide receiver group, even though it looked very, very thin going into last year. So, hey, if you want to make another pick there in wide receiver, I could get down with that. I know people are going to be like, oh, well, we got our guys. Do you? I don't know. You never know. You never know for those, at least. So cornerback, wide receiver, those are kind of the tier two guys who I would take in that range. And again, a lot of times when it comes to drafting, I think you could do pretty well just following these rules, looking at some consensus boards and, not having to kill yourself over this. Okay. I think we're all done here. So appreciate everyone tuning in. Went for an hour and a half. Maybe I'll do these more often. You know what? The other day I was talking to Matt Waldman because I was trying to get into his process just like on a private call. And I was like, I got to do these conversations more often. I'm just very lazy and I don't like to arrange them. And I'm, an introvert and a misanthrope all at the same time. So those are not good combinations when it comes to scheduling and doing interviews. So that's a problem. But these maybe I should be doing more often. I just fell off of it. Okay, so yeah, do they have a replacement for Bakhtiari on the roster already? Okay, yeah, well, we'll see. Okay, sorry, I gotta ignore the comments here. So I'll try to do these more often. I think I'm gonna talk to Benjamin Robinson some next week, who does the grinding the mock stuff. We'll talk about the draft, and I'll come after the draft. Maybe I'll just pop in and do these periodically. Sometimes I enjoy the sound of my own voice, the dulcet tones a little bit more than even talking to a guest. But anyway, I appreciate everyone tuning in. wrap it up here. For those who are on podcast form, you know, come join us. Come join us. Unexpected Points on YouTube. Subscribe there. Get in here. Oh, you know what? I noticed. I didn't even realize I had this available. Someone just dropped me a 10 spot in here. One man's Odyssey. Thank you. I didn't even know. I guess I've reached some sort of threshold where you guys can do that. If you want to throw some money at me, I'll take it. Audience capture might end up happening here, but I will take it. But I enjoy the banter either way, and appreciate everyone taking the time to tune in. Enjoy your weekend. All this stuff. Let me see. What do I got going on? Is there any good? What's going on in Premier League? I guess we have to see what's going on there. I'm very anti Real Madrid, so that hurt the Champions League this last week. What do you got on the Premier League schedule? Let me just look at this to figure out, since everything else is over at this point. Matches. I know this is the podcast and you guys love. Fulham versus Liverpool. Oh, man, Liverpool's falling apart. Arsenal versus Wolves. Yeah, I mean, City's going to take it again. That's the way it goes. Anyway, all right, so I'll be talking to you guys next week. Thanks for tuning in.